all yours.
All right. Hey everybody, I'm Bonnie. I'm an alcoholic. It's an honor to be here. Thanks for asking me to come and speak. My sobriety day is January 8th, 2005. And alcoholism is a very cunning and baffling disease. My drinking had nothing to do with alcohol. My drinking had to do with escapism. I just, you know, from a very, very young age, I couldn't find a door to get out of right here, right now. I couldn't. It didn't matter how far down the road I walked or where I went, or I couldn't find a door out until I found alcohol. And my parents were alcoholics. I grew up in the traditional alcoholic family, you know, the violent alcoholic father and the mother who's spitting out babies trying to fix things. And you know, when I was born, my parents were in such turmoil already that basically it was like a survivor shelter, you know. I mean, my dad would, you know, was an unpredictable alcoholic, so sometimes he'd be the sweetest person in the world, the most cherished person in my heart. I mean, and then without cause or reason, he was just so brutally violent. I mean, machetes to my mom and, you know, beating her in front of my sister and I. We're like 2 and 3 years old, you know, experiencing this trauma, really, of getting scooted from one room to the other, or letting, you know, my mom's dashing us all over the house trying to stash us somewhere so we'll be safe. And so it's just chaotic and it's turmoil. And I got nothing to arm myself with, you know. I got nothing. So my mom had the courage to leave my dad when I was like 2, 3 years old. And she went to Florida from North Carolina, and she became a dancer to support having 2 girls. And she met my stepdad, who's an alcoholic. And, you know, he was, you know, he'd been in Vietnam and seen some horrific things and experienced a lot of horrible things. And so he was doing the same thing I learned how to do later on, you know, find some way to escape. So he worked, and he worked hard. And I didn't know it, you know, then, but he had been married before and had 2 kids, and he abandoned them and met my mom, who's, you know, a dancer, got 2 kids, so he rescues her. And you know, it's just chaos. It's every day is about alcohol. There were times when I never went hungry, but, you know, we did the thrift store and the pot pies were for $1 and the coupon thing, but we had the Jim Beam. You know, you had to, you know, so, you know, it took precedence. You had to have the right kind of alcohol, and you had to have the big bottle. You know, my life was chaos from the crib, man. Chaos from the crib. And I was left to my own devices and my own, you know, my own time, and being left on my own, because my mom would be at work or my dad would be at work, or my mom would be at the house but not really present. So I'd be off, you know, I'd climb to the top of the tree in the backyard to where the branches break, and then I fall through the tree and hope that something catches me, and, you know, I'm beat up and I'm bruised by a tree, and God, if anybody saw me, they'd think it was my parents beating me to death, right? I mean, my mom saw a newspaper article about a fire that had been started in the house by a faulty gas stove. And, you know, some children had died or something in the fire. And so my mom tells us, you know, she reads this article and she tells us, you know, hey, this is what I want you to do. If you're ever home alone, which is often the case, you know, 5 and 6 years old, my sister and I are alone. If you're ever home alone and there's ever a fire, and you get stuck, and you're upstairs, and you can't get downstairs to get out, I want you to take all the clothes and all the towels and linens and pillows and anything you can get out of the window so you can jump out the window. So as soon as they left for work, as soon as they left for work, it seemed like a good idea. Threw everything out the window, jumped, you know. Of course, I rolled over on my ankle, had to go to the hospital when my parents get home. The clothes and the leaves and the ants and the dirt and are all sitting on the couch because we drug those inside. But my parents, my dad is spanking me in a circle, you know, and I'm hopping on one foot because they don't know that I'm injured. They just see this mess that we've made. So I end up going to the hospital. And I think that was probably the first undoing, you know, when a kid goes to the hospital with an injury. And I'm a left to my own devices. I'm not taught how to clean myself. I'm not taught how to clothe myself. I'm not taught any of that stuff. I'm just kind of there. So when I showed up at the hospital, I've got this injury, and my parents are drunk. You know, I'm pretty sure somebody asked some questions or made some presumptions about what might be happening in the house, so they probably assumed that I was being harmed by my parents. And I was, but it was neglect. It wasn't violence. They never sexually abused me. They never beat me, but it was more of the abandonment and the neglect that happened. And shortly after that, my parents were again at work, and my sister and I went for a walk around the block by ourselves, and a lady saw us, so she brought us into her house, and she gave us each a Pepsi, and she talked to us for a while, and she asked a bunch of questions. It was tricky. And then she walked us home, and it was dark, and there was no parents there, and so later, my sister and I, we put ourselves to bed, and then there was a knock at the door, and I remember the red and blue lights outside, and the police were there to take us away. So we get down to the police station, and they give us, they give us milk and donuts. Later on, it's called commissary, and you have to buy it from them, but I'll explain that later on. they gave these to me for free. And, they were my friends, They were my friends. They weren't out to hurt me. They just wanted to know, have you been left home alone before? Well, yeah. That's just normal, right? I don't think there's anything wrong with the way the things are. I just think that's the way it is, you know. So we ended up going to this shelter kind of place, this housing kind of place, really. Remember when my sister and I walk in the door, it's really dark and it's really late and I don't know where we are, and I'm not at home, that's for sure. And there's all these babies crying in rooms, you know, these closed rooms. There's all these babies crying. And this lady shows us where our bed is. And I don't know why I knew, because my parents didn't teach me to pray. We didn't go to church, you know. I don't know why I knew. I don't know why I believed in God. But I got on my knees. I was like 5 years old. I got on my knees and I prayed, you know, God, please let us go back home. And we were there for a couple weeks, and they were, people, it's taking me a while to kind of really look at this, but people don't always, foster children, for the right reason. So we were there for a couple weeks, and, if you didn't do what they said or turn the ice cream right or, scoop the poop right out of the, the cow, whatever, the foster father made homemade paddles, with designs in them. So, I can remember standing up against the wood panel, and just crying because I've just been spanked. And all I can do, I can't move. I'm not supposed to move. I'm just supposed to stand there, So, this is a little much. And I don't have any alcohol yet. So, and I remember that it was very important to my parents, but it hadn't, I was 5 years old, so it wasn't an option for me then. But I went to, we got moved from there to another place, and, the irony is, I don't know how this all happens to, for me, I look at these kind of traumas like this. Oh my God, this has happened to somebody else right now. It's not happened to me right now, thank God, but this happens every day to people. This stuff is horrific. So for us to get sober and, work the steps of the program and work the program itself and become better human beings so we can intervene or be productive members of some kind of activism towards that, that's an honor to be able to live, to be able to do that. The second foster home, the first day my sister and I were there, we were wearing our little dresses to improve, impress the people and be welcome in their home. And they had this 12-year-old boy that was there already. I think he was threatened by the fact that these two little girls just showed up. So he squirted toothpaste in the linen closet and said, my sister and I did it. So we were troublemakers and liars our very first day. And that's how we were treated our very first day. So he was twisted from whatever had happened to him. He's in a foster home, so something wasn't good somewhere in his life. And he would, stop my sister or I in the middle of the hallway in the middle of the day and French kiss us, forcefully French kiss us. And he was always bossing us around and telling us what to do. And One night, I was having fun with the foster mother. I was playing Go Fish at the table. And he's sitting there, and I'm laughing because I'm having a good time. And he starts kicking me under the table in the shin, telling me, go to bed. And I don't want to go to bed because I'm having fun. You know, so you just go ahead and kick me. So he kicked me again, and I'm like, ah. I'm stubborn. No, I'm not going to get from this table. And he kicked me hard enough. And I decided I was going to bed. And he came into the bedroom a few minutes later, and he punched me right in the eye. And he says, why didn't you go to bed when I told you to? And I don't know what I said, but and he said, oh. And he realized my eye's starting to swell right away. He says, you're going to have a black eye in the morning. I said, no, I'm not. He says, yes, you are. No, I'm not. You want me to make sure you are? No, no, no. And then he realizes, oh, he's got to come up with a story. So he tells me that I need to tell the foster mother I slept on the top bunk of the bed and that I fell off the top bunk of the bed and hit my eye on the dresser. And that's how I hurt my eye. So the next morning, I don't say anything to anybody. I just mosey over to the kitchen table. And the foster mom brings over this Tupperware dish of Rice Krispies and sees my eye. She's like, what happened to you? He's sitting across the table from me, so I know what my line is. I fell off the bed. I hit my eye on the corner of the dresser. And so he goes, no, she didn't. I saw her yesterday, and she's sitting on the bed in her room going like this, hitting herself in the eye. And she believed him. I don't even know what to say to this kind of stuff, man. You know? I mean, you can only crawl so far inside yourself trying to disappear, you know? And I don't have alcohol yet, but I got the ism. No doubt I got the ism. So when they sent me off to school, and the school sent me right back home because, you know, they're going to have some kid with his eye out to here, walking around their school. Somebody got called, some services got called, I guess it was HRS back there at the time, Human Rehabilitation Services. And, they came and removed me from the home, and my sister was left there to be in that house. They put me in this place called Great Oaks Village because I'm the one with the problem. I'm the problem. And, phooey. Good to have a big God. So I went to this place called Great Oaks Village. It's a, more of an institution. They have housing for different ages, and they have the school on site, and they have, you know, they have functions that you do, and they have Easter egg things, and, you know, they have, it's like, you know, like it would be in a family, you know, and so it was a sense of stability, and it was a sense of normalcy, and it was no chaos, and there was no abuse, and there was, you know, I knew when to make my bed, I knew how to brush my teeth. I knew how to fold my clothes. I was taught these things here. You know, how to fold my clothes and put them in a drawer and, you know, do all that stuff. And my parents used to come and visit me. I got my first pair of roller skates, you know, telling my age, but it was the one with the metal wheels. And I loved roller skating, man. I just loved it. I could spend hours on the basketball court out there. Just hours, circling around. Whee! I loved it. And then one day, it was just after Easter, you know, things were going well, and they told me to pack up my stuff, so I thought I was going home. I mean, every part of my being thought I was going home. And I got in the car with this guy who's taking me somewhere, and I asked, you know, am I going home? And he's like, no, you're going to another foster home. And that moment of, I was so devastated, you know, like I wasn't going home. I was so frightened. Where am I going? This is safe. If I'm not going home, where am I going? Ended up I was going to another foster home, and the foster father was a police officer, and the foster mother was of Puerto Rican descent, and they'd had a large family, two sons, two daughters. One daughter didn't live in the house, the others all lived in the house. But the first day I was there, we were all sitting in the living room. I was standing against the door frame. My cardboard box that I brought all my stuff in is sitting up by my bed. I haven't removed anything or put anything away because, you know, I don't know these people. And so far, things have not turned out well except for this place I just left. And I don't know why I'm here. But I'm leaning against the door jamb, and the foster father is sitting here. And his cop car's in the driveway. And the family's all sitting there, and they're watching the television. And I have my pretty blue Easter dress on. And he's got his hand on my ass, up my dress. And they're all sitting there. And I don't know how to defend myself or say anything. I'm just so frozen. What can I do? Nobody here's going to say anything. And what am I supposed to say? And I don't know what to do. And, you know, at dinner that night, he's got his hand under the table and he's playing with my leg. It's like, put me in my place right here. Nobody's going to say anything. You're not going to say anything. And you're not going to do anything. And you're just going to let me. You know, so for the time that I was there, he would wake me up in the middle of the night. I'm 6 years old. He would wake me up in the middle of the night and make me perform sexually. And then I would get up in the morning and brush my teeth and get dressed for school and walk down to elementary school. And I did that for almost a year with nobody intervening or saying anything and not knowing how to intervene for myself, not knowing how to say anything for myself. And so I just, like a robot, I was so numb. So, you know, I was just so numb, I just left, right, forward. I don't even know how. I don't think I ever really did well in school during this time. I couldn't function. You know, I couldn't focus on the task at hand. But eventually, one of his daughters walked in the room and saw him standing over me, and you know, knew because he did the same thing to her. Here she's 17 years old. I'm 6 years old. He did the same thing to her. This thing has been going on a very long time. He's used his power and abused his power, and probably handpicked children for his home. Being a police officer and having communication with people that are in the field of rehabilitation services. So, when she asked me if he was doing that, I honestly said yes. I was so relieved that somebody had asked me. And I said yes. And she went into his bedroom and screamed at him and called him every horrid name with his wife laying right beside him. And she didn't get up. She didn't do anything. She just laid in bed. And the next day, the sister said, you know, you've got to tell her yourself. You've got to walk in there and you got to tell her yourself that he's been doing this. So I did the next day. She was making lunch or dinner or something, and she just ignored me like I wasn't there at all. Like I wasn't saying the words I was saying. Like I wasn't saying the words I was saying about her husband. She just ignored me, wouldn't acknowledge me at all. And, you know, at that moment, at that table, I remember making a very clear decision for myself. Nobody in this world is ever going to protect me. Nobody is ever going to love me. Nobody's ever. I don't belong here. I don't belong in this world. I don't belong here. Something happened somewhere wrong. I should not be here. And really quickly after that, for whatever reason, I got to be reunited with my parents, who lived like four blocks away from this house. They lived in a hotel. When I did get home, what I remember is the beer cans on the floor. The alcohol's still there, right? And, you know, it's been a hard thing to realize that, you know, my parents, I used to give my mom a lot of credit for the work that she did, that she had to do to get us back. She had to go to groups or do this or do that and jump through the hoops and all that stuff to get us back, but she didn't know what to do with us when we got there. I was just a burden. I'm another problem. She's got an alcoholic husband. She doesn't know how to function. Now she's done and jumped through all these hoops, and now she's got these kids. What the hell do you do with these things? Right? We've been gone a couple years. She's got shame and remorse and guilt she's lugging around with her, and there's booze and alcohol and all this stuff, and then these kids, and there's all this mess. You know? And so, unfortunately, I had to pass by that house where that police officer lived in that foster home from the time I was 8 till I was 12 years old. And, you know, and I'm developing age-wise, but I'm not developing emotionally. Because when I get home, my parents don't know what's happened to me. I can't talk to them. You know, I'm a problem already because I'm here. Right? So I don't want to be more of a problem, and I don't want to create a burden. I don't want to make a problem, something you got to fix. I'll just be here. And, you know, I didn't know what to do with any of that stuff. I was just acting out, you know. And naturally, I'm 10 years old, and I'm acting out because I have no self-worth, and I have no self-esteem, and I have no family, and I have no bond, and I'm not connected to anything in this world whatsoever at all. We don't stay in one place long enough to be connected anywhere anyway. So, I mean, that was the longest place that we lived in, that 4-year stretch. not a good place to live when you have to walk by that every single day on your way to elementary and junior high school. But, you know, I started acting out promiscuously and breaking into buildings and stealing stuff out of people's cars. You know, and I'm screaming for help the best way I know how. And at one point, my parents were at their wit's end. I'm skipping school and I'm in elementary. You know, I'm hanging out with the homeless people along the railroad tracks because I fit with these guys real well, right? I know what they're doing, and I like what they're doing. I think I'll do what they're doing, you know. I'll be aimless. I'll wander. I'll have nothing to lose. I have not a lot to carry. And I can leave whatever I got and go on down the road. No problem. And but I'm promiscuous, and I'm, you know, I don't have any self-worth, so I'm using what I got and what I think I'm worth. My mom's letting me go off with people. I'm 11 years old, and she's letting this 22-year-old guy in the Navy take me off with him, you know, buy me roller skates and take me to the skating rink. And, you know, they have no idea or that's the denial of these kind of things that are so horrific to look at, to know how to intervene for situations like this. I've never been in it myself because I don't have any kids, but that's why I don't have any kids, because can you imagine? I would overprotect them to death. They would hate me. I would be too paranoid to let them go anywhere at all with anybody. But I'm acting out, and I, you know, doing what I'm doing, and, you know, I blame myself for that. Like, it's my fault. I acted promiscuous. See, that's my fault. it's just all I had. So I, you know, we get stoned with people and drank with people, and I'm 10 years old, and it's the first time I find that door I was looking for, that out, right? Because it wasn't about alcohol. It was just the way that I found out. And when I found that out, these two things came together, promiscuity and alcohol and drugs. So that's it. That's what I got. That's my toolbox, right? At one point, they had tried to intervene for me, and my parents drove me to this place called the Sheriff's Youth Ranch, right? And it's this pastures, and they walk me around, show me the horses, they show me the cottage I'm going to live in, and I'm scared to death, because this is what's on the surface. But see, I know what goes on behind the doors, because I've lived it my whole life, and there's no way I'm going to volunteer to go in there. And because I don't know what that is, you know, I don't know if it's safe or not. I just make a presumption that it's not. And I know what my parents are, and they're not. But I know that they're not, and that's predictable. So I'll just stay with my parents. I was hyperventilating in the car, afraid to get out of the car and go to the sheriff's youth ranch because I was terrified of what was going to happen next. So I just went back with my parents. And anyway, you know, when I found alcohol and drugs, it was just a relief. It was the only relief I'd ever known. And all that stuff, you know, never got dealt with. All those emotions and feelings and traumas and stuck places, it just got stored. They never went anywhere. They just got masked with the alcohol. And so I drink and I drug like a mad woman. I couldn't get enough. There was just never enough. You know, I lived my life unable to function in any kind of job, fit anywhere, have any kind of relationship, feel a sense of worthiness about anything. I would get an opportunity and I would poop all over it and take it away from myself because I can't sustain this. And in truth, I couldn't sustain it because I'd have hope and I'd come out of the gate and I'd have confidence in myself. That even though I'm uneducated and I quit school in the eighth grade, that doesn't mean anything. I got confidence. I'm smart. I'm intelligent. I can figure this out. And I'd get a great job. And I'd poop all over it. I can't maintain my emotions. That internal voice that just tick, 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 ticks at me that I'm not worth this. I'm not good enough for this. And so, you know, eventually I'm 22 years old and I drink myself into jail finally. And, I get arrested for the first time, and really, it's not a DUI, and I didn't get drunk in public. I didn't get an alcohol drug charge. I got a drug charge, because the alcohol wasn't enough for me. Because what happened was, with alcohol, I didn't like the effect that you pass out. You know, My MO is not, oh, this is cozy. I just want to chill on this for a while. No, mine is go. You don't go very far on alcohol. Not this alcoholic anyway. So, you know, I had to substitute some other things in there to get me going, right? So, you know, I found the cocaine and I got arrested, and then a couple of weeks later, I got arrested again because I'm not very good at the off button. I don't know how to stop. See, I'm at the point now, very early on. By the time I was 18 years old, there was little I wouldn't do to get out of here right now, because I desperately wanted to die. I desperately couldn't go on living the way I felt. And then I couldn't go on living the way I acted when I drink and I drug. And then it's this insidious cycle. And God, I'm just wishing God would just let me die. Please just let me die. He won't. You know, instead he sends his police officers. They keep interrupting the process. Because that's the only thing that ever stopped me. I mean, I got arrested when I was, you know, the couple times there when I was 22. And then I spent the next 3 years doing a 1-year drug court program trying to keep the felony off my record. I couldn't do it. You know, I'd get 11 months and then poof, you know, and then I'd violate my probation, be back over again, cop another charge and probation, get arrested, not show up. Oh, I'm high, so I just won't go to probation. So they're looking for me again. Oh, I'm arrested. Probation, I'm arrested. 13 years of this. 13 years of in and out of jails and institutions. And, you know, oftentimes there's like a good 5 years there where I wouldn't get another charge. I just violate probation. I'm supposed to be on probation. I'm supposed to stay clean and sober. I'm supposed to show up for appointments. I'm supposed to do this. Can't do that. That doesn't work because I'm not going to come the way you want me to. So you're going to violate me. So I just won't show up. And then, you know, yeah. So amazingly for 13 years, I did, you know, 2 months here. 3 months here, 2 months here, 3 months here, 2 years on the run, catch me when you can, you know, and then I'd get caught and then I'd do some time. And I graduated finally to prison. You know, this judge that I had, he's like, yeah, I know your story. I know your story. And you're going to do it again. And you're not going to do it this time because I'm sending you to prison for a couple years. And remember that feeling I talked about having in that institution when I was a kid? How it was safe, and you knew how to brush your teeth, and you knew how to fold your clothes? Very familiar. Comfortable. You know, as long as you had money coming in where you can get your canteen, right? And you got a visitor that comes in to visit you so you can break the monotony up a little bit. Pretty functional. I can do that. And so what was cool about it was I got to get to a work release in a workplace. So I actually got to work on the fire rangers' trucks and equipment and their heavy equipment and their tractors and stuff. So it was kind of cool. And I got to go out of the gate of the prison and willingly come back in, voluntarily come back to prison every day. Like they opened the gate and let me walk out and they let me come back in. They're like, oh, seems reasonable. I can't do that under any other circumstances. But in prison and in jail, the boundaries are clear. The boundaries and the rules and everything are very clear. They don't move around. They don't change. You know, you break a rule, there's a disciplinary action, and you lose a couple of days of your freedom. You know, so it was very easy for me to understand the rules and the regulations. They stayed the same. And I got to go to a work release center. I was there. I got a job with a construction company. I learned how to run a front-end loader. And it was really cool because I built bridges down in Florida. And I learned how to put lifts in and run nuclear equipment and, you know, just all these, I mean, it's really cool. I'm this chick out of prison. I'm cruising down the road in my 966 F-Cat. And it's big and it's bad. I'm bumping along and I'm learning all these skills and it's really cool. I love it. It's like the first time I'm able to function in society, follow the rules of society, feel good about myself, save money for the first time in my life. Have a savings account. And I'm, you know, what was I, 30, 33, 34? And, yeah, 33. So you know what's cool is all through these years, in all those jails and institutions, no matter the state, whether it was a jail or a prison, you guys brought in meetings. you guys brought in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And little by little, every time you brought a meeting in, even though I've got a wall of denial and I don't know alcohol has anything to do with the fact that I'm in jail or prison, I don't have any idea that all of these years, it has one thing to do with alcohol. Nothing. But, you know, you guys brought these steps in, and you brought the traditions in, and you brought the big book in, and you brought your story of recovery in, and you brought your hope in. And I get these little seeds planted. Because I'm telling you, I got a lot of soil. I got a lot of soil to work with, so I took a lot of seeds, you know. So, yeah, got a lot to clean out of here, clean out of the clock up here, you know. So it took a lot for me to hear it and hear it and hear it and hear it. And when I get out of jail and then have to go to mandatory meetings, and I'd go to the meetings and I'd drink the coffee and I'd smoke the cigarettes and I'd listen to the meeting and I wouldn't talk to anybody and I'd get the numbers and never call them, and then I'd run out of the meeting, and then, you know, I might go to those like two or three times, but then I'm off on my own again. So with that work release center, we had meetings once a week. And I loved them. I just loved them because I'm in the institution. I'm not drinking. I'm not drugging. I'm working and I'm functioning. And I've been locked up for 2 years. So it's the longest I've ever been without a drink or a drug since I was 10 years old, except for those 2 or 3 months, you know, at a time. So this is all very new and refreshing and hopeful and, you know, but damn, I got a disease. And it tells me alcohol isn't my problem. Alcohol isn't even why I'm here. So I'll go to Alcoholics Anonymous because I like the message, but I'll just use that towards cocaine. So I won't do the cocaine, but I can still have my White Russians, you know? And, you know, I've said that for the whole time I was drinking. Oh, man, because, you know, usually, I don't know about you. Some of you might do this because I've seen stories where you guys drive down the road on tractors drunk to get another six-pack, but I break into houses. I steal people's cars. I take their credit cards. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I pull when I'm out there. And it all starts with this idea that I can have a drink. Just the idea that I can have a drink, you might as well kiss your car goodbye. If I'm thinking I can have a drink, it's over. And that's the kind of alcoholic and drug addict that I am. There are no rules and regulations for me. And so I'm getting ready to get out of this prison, and I'm feeling good, and I've got money saved, and I'm trying to make a decision about where I'm going to live or where I'm going to go. And there's this person in my life that, you know, basically, let's just be blunt. He picked me up on the side of the road a couple years before this, you know, and then, you know, I would call him when I needed some money and he needed a favor, you know. And then he would visit me in prison. And he would put money in my commissary when I was in prison. He would visit me when I was in work release center. And he wanted me to come and live with him. And he had two kids at home. And I'm thinking, man, you're twisted. You want me, the girl you picked up on the side of the road, who now you're in love with, to come and live with you and subject me to your family. Because I won't hurt your children directly, but what I do to you is going to drive you batty enough that your actions and what you're going to be like towards your kids is going to be horrific, and I'm not going to be responsible for that. So I asked my sister to look in the newspaper and find some place that had a room for rent that was close by where I could get to my probation and do what I'm supposed to do. And I go to this house and rent this room, and I'm there 2 days with that idea that I can still have my White Russians. And I skip right over the alcohol and go straight to the cocaine, and I'm on a 4-month bender. And I'm going from county to county to county, and I'm breaking laws and breaking into people's houses and stealing people's cars. And I'm on go all day long, every single day, and, you know, until I fall out of a chair or wreck into the concrete post on the road. You know, the thing about being here today is just knowing how big God is, because the only thing I ever had in case of emergency was God. That's it. I mean, I'd wake up driving down the road at 50 miles an hour in a car, wake up just before the concrete post, and the only thing I have time to do is say, oh God, before I hit it. Bam! Woo! Fire, flames, woo! Bruises, gotta go, get out of the car and take off down the road. I shouldn't even be here. You know, but I am. You know, that 4 months of craziness, I ended up on the news in Florida. And so I'd met a person at a gas or at a 7-Eleven, and he was there with his girlfriend. We hung out, we partied, we all hung out, and then he gave me his card and said, you know, hey, if you ever want to come to Virginia sometime, come on up. So when I realized I was on the news, it was time for me to go. Hey, how you doing? So I came up to Virginia, and I ended up in Baltimore and Washington, and it was just far more dangerous than I'd ever been in. You know, I'd been walking down the streets looking at my shoelaces for years, or my bare feet, or whatever, flip-flop, whatever I was wearing, you know. I never had anything for more than a couple of weeks, really, whether it be clothes or your car. You know, I just never had anything for very long. And anyway, so I got up there and I got into a bit of trouble. And, you know, he came and picked me up and I ended up crashing or trying to pass out in a hotel, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't come down and I couldn't go up, you know, and I was in this horrible place of the in-between. And I thought, well, it's 4 o'clock in the morning and I can't get any alcohol, but I bet if I walk down the street, I'll meet somebody who wants to party, right? And they did, man. I did. I met a couple of really cool guys. Loudoun County's finest. Yep, they wanted to party. They wanted to part me, probably, because I gave them like 6 different names when they pulled me over on the side of the road. You know, it's obvious that I am lost and probably pretty dangerous. I'm wearing a coat that's like 3 sizes too big for me. I've got heroin in my pocket, 6 IDs that aren't mine, you know. And I'm trying to give them some lame excuse that I'm going to that hotel, the one that's behind me. I'm walking the opposite direction. I'm trying to come up with this really thrifty story and they're not buying it. But, you know, they were done after my, you know, I don't know, 4th or 5th name that I gave them. They were ready to put me in the back of the car. So I went down to jail and I got a $20,000 bond, and I ended up going to another jail for about 30 days. And I talked this person into bonding me out for $20,000 down in Florida. And it took a good 30 days working that phone, making promises I know I'm not going to keep, you know, because all I want to do is get out. Just, I know what's out there. I know what Florida is. I know I'm a fugitive from justice. I still have more prison time hanging over my head. Now I've got more charges. Now I've got this mess. Just, if I can get this door open, you'll never see this girl again. I don't know where I'm going, but I'm going to run for all my might, right? And that's what I'm pretty convinced I'm going to do. And I'm getting ready to get bonded out, and I know that all this stuff is cooking, and I'm trying to figure out what to do with myself when I do, if I do get out, because I'm assuming that these warrants from Florida are going to pop up, and they're not going to actually let me out of the jail. But I got bonded out that night, and what happened for me was that I decided I'd stop beating myself. I'd punished myself enough. I punished myself enough. All this running and all this damage that I do and all this sickness, this craziness that I live in. And I'm 35, and for 35 years, you know, or 25 of that 35 years, I've just been trying to kill myself, you know? I literally, there's been a couple of times that I literally attempted killing myself, and that didn't even work, you know? So I'm tired. I'm tired. There's got to be some other way, and I still don't know alcohol has anything to do with my problem. But at that moment, getting ready to get out of jail, I did say that, I got to show up for court because this person just gave me $20,000, and they're a millionaire, so they're really not going to miss it. You know, too bad for them. Sorry for their luck. They gave me the money, but, and that was my attitude, but I wanted to do right, and I was trying to figure out, how am I going to do right? I never do right. How am I going to show up for court? Right? Well, okay, that's a lot of stress, so I'm going to have something. Okay, I still have my white Russians. And I heard myself say that. It was the first time in all those years of jails and institutions and trouble that I'd ever heard myself saying, still have the white Russians, but I'd said it every time. I just never heard myself say it. When I heard myself say it, I thought, oh, wait, that doesn't work. It always ends me up right back here. And then I got angry. I was angry that I couldn't have alcohol. And then I thought, whoa, I mean, I'm really angry I can't have alcohol. If I'm that angry, I might be one of those alcoholics who just doesn't drink a lot. Huh. What's life look like without alcohol? And I was trying to figure out, okay, show up, record. No, I'm not going to show up, record. I'm going to run. Oh, I know what I'll do. I'll get this guy to drop me off in Baltimore or Washington somewhere, and then I'm thinking, oh, I'm just going to commit the same crime. It's going to be very exhausting. And really, the bottom line was I saw myself out there, and this time I was laying in a ditch in an alley, and I've been raped and sodomized. My teeth are knocked out. I'm bludgeoned. I'm bleeding to death. Police are not going to come and help me. Nobody's going to come and help me this time. I'm going to die like that. And then I was still standing in jail and had a choice. I don't have to do that. It was the first time I ever knew I had a choice. Never knew or had any idea that I had a choice before then. What happened was my bondsman gave me a $20 bill and let me use his cell phone to call Alcoholics Anonymous. I asked where a meeting was. I went to a meeting with my garbage bag, and I had paperwork, and I had some candy bars. And I had my check in my back pocket with no ID. And I went into the meeting with a few minutes left, and I surrendered. I said, I don't know how to live any other way than what I do. I don't even know how to do anything different than what I do. I don't even know where I'm going to go. I don't know what I'm going to do when I walk out of this room. I don't know anything. I just don't want to do what I do anymore. And I picked up a chip. And I missed halftime, so I put that $20 bill in the basket, and nobody saw that part. All they saw was me squirreling out all the ones. Right? So they thought I was swiping the basket. So somebody comes over to me after the meeting, and they start a conversation with me. They want to get to know me a little better, find out who this chick is and why she thinks she can take the basket money. And they actually gave me a place to stay that night. There's another alcoholic helping another alcoholic. They gave me a room to stay in, and I woke up the next day in this person's house, and there was nobody there. And they know I just got out of jail. Okay, so they know what I'm capable of. And this guy was clueless. I mean, he was a nice person, a sponsor, the sponsee, talked to him, had this long conversation about this person. I get there, and the sponsor, you know, goes home, and then he's going, what did I do? I just sent that girl to my sponsee's house. What was I thinking? So they're, like, burning up the phone all night long, making sure he's okay because I'm at his house. But the next day, he goes to work, and he doesn't think twice that I'm in his house. Until he starts talking to his friends at work about, yeah, this person, she's at my house, you know, she just got out of jail. And they're like, dude, she's going to rob you blind, man. He's like, oh, crap. But what happened was it's the next day and I'm out of jail and I still got all this stuff to face, you know, and I don't know how to do it. But I'd gotten some people's numbers. So I called a woman that morning and asked her to come and pick me up and take me to a meeting. And she took me to a meeting. I haven't had a drink or a drug or committed a crime since. And that was, you know, well, I got out on February 9th, but I count my sobriety date as January 8th, that time being locked up. I went to meetings, you know, and even though I was confused and baffled about what was going to happen, that was God doing for me what I could not do for myself. Because if it went for the intervention, and that's the irony of the story that we all get to live as we learn a little bit more and remove a lot, and as God does a lot of work on us, is how much harm was caused by a police officer and how many times was my ass saved by a police officer. Because it weren't for all those interruptions since I didn't stop and the police arrested me. And here it is, I'm walking down the side of the road again and the police pulls over and then go back to jail again. That's the irony, you know. So it's like learning how to forgive and then have gratitude is a process. It doesn't all go away, obviously, you know. But you know, the stuff that I drink over and I drugged over. When I got here, man, I was doing a step a month with my sponsor. We were zipping because I was going to court every month. I literally packed my bag with a big book, the 12 to 12, white underwear, no wire bra, long socks, long johns, all that stuff, and I'd go to court with my bag because I didn't know if that day those warrants from Florida were going to pop in or they were going to take me to jail. But I came ready, and I was sober, you know, willingly. It was the first time in my life I was ever willingly sober, willing to feel, willing to face, willing to just deal with life on life's terms. Like, I'm done running. I'm not going to run. I'm going to do this thing. And I wanted to run, but for me, I got something real, real key about this program and the honesty part. I can't live somewhere else because I wanted to pretend like I could go to another state, give a fake name, come up with a social security number, get a job, pay bills, and be normal and not drink, living a lie. And I knew that was self-deception. And I knew that wasn't going to work, so what happened was I went to prison at 9 months of sobriety for some Florida stuff. When I got out of prison, they extradited me to a jail. I had a warrant. From that jail, I had another warrant.
from that jail, I had another warrant. While I was in prison, I actually got extradited, went to court, settled up a matter, went back to prison. So that one got taken care of while I was already locked up. I get to come back to Virginia from Florida, okay? And I'm here, and what I'm facing with all that stuff that I did on that little 4 or 5 month tirade that I had was 40 years in prison, because 15 years for burglary. You know, a couple of burglaries, a couple grand thefts, a couple uttering forged instruments, you know, all this stuff. And the state is not offering this girl one day less. Not one day less. My record's this thick. I'm a failure at this. You can give me every opportunity in the world and I'll poop on it. I've proved it over and over and over again, and they're not offering me anything less. And I've been sober now, you know, at that point, 2.5 years, you know, and I'm dealing with this on a day-to-day basis. I'm 39 years old and I'm about to go to prison. And I'm sober. And I'm living right. And I'm doing the right thing. And I'm not harming people. And I'm making amends. And I'm going to meetings. And I'm sober. And I'm working this thing. And isn't that the irony? I'm going to go to prison. And guess what? I was responsible for my actions. I had to be willing to deal with the consequences of my actions. And that's what this program taught me. Because, man, I've been a victim. And really, I was a victim. I was a victim of a lot of stuff. But to have a victim mentality when it comes to dealing with the stuff I'm responsible for is not appropriate. Right? This is how the program works, right? That big old shift is, you know, wait a second, that's not how this works. 180-degree flip, you know, of, wait, no, I've got to become responsible for my actions and deal with the consequences of my actions. So, at 3.5 years of sobriety, 15 people from the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous who had become my family, my support, the only sense of belonging I ever had, the most welcome I ever felt in my life, the most loved in spite of my actions in the past and the way that I lived, the least judged I've ever been, you know, just, you know, that gave this girl a home, you know, and 15 people from the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous flew down to Florida. We all stayed in a hotel. We got up in the morning, and we had breakfast, and we chatted, and we laughed, and we took pictures. You know, they just kept telling me, we're going to be here, whether you're inside or you're outside. We're going to be here. So know that you've got a place. Whatever happens, we're going to be right here for you. And I'd never been told that before. You know, because even though my parents were alive, they weren't available. They weren't engaged. There was no relationship due to alcoholism. And that day when I went to court, man, I'm telling you, it was a very scary moment. And there's no way I could have done it by myself. And it took everything that God provided, you know, that serenity prayer, you know. Because I don't have that kind of courage, dude. You know, grant it to me because I ain't got it. But my pants, I was wearing these khaki pants and I swear they were vibrating. I was so scared. The victims didn't show up. I got 15 people over here and nobody over here against me. 15 people over here for me. Nobody against me. The state over here, he won't offer a day less in 40 years. And thank you, God. Thank you, God, because if they would have said 10 years, it would have took it. They didn't offer me anything less. I just pled to the judge. I just had been sober 3.5 years. I just showed up willingly and flew on a plane to get here. You didn't have to lock me up. You didn't have to chase me down. I'm here willingly to be accountable for my actions because there is no door anymore for me to run out, you know, to run to. Alcohol isn't an option for me. That's how I feel. It's not a real option for me. It's not fast enough. It's just not. It's not. I've tried many times. It's just not fast enough for me. So alcohol is not an option. And, you know, with all the love and support that I'd had, often myself wasn't an option. And running wasn't an option because I felt responsible to you people. I felt accountable to you people. You'd invested in me. You'd invested time and money and your prayers and your everything about what you've learned to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You invested in me as a human being more than anybody ever did without poor motive at all. Your motives were so pure. to help me, just a suffering alcoholic, deal with what I had to deal with no matter what the outcome was. Nobody said, today you're going to go home, Bonnie, when I went to court that day. I didn't know what I was going to get. But when she sentenced me, the judge sentenced me to 15 years in the Department of Corrections. So that was 15 years in prison. I'm thinking to myself, well, that's better than 40, but I don't even know how to process that, right? Because what did she just say? what does that mean? I'm a little lost. I don't know what to, and then she says, oops, I mean probation. 15 years, Department of Corrections, probation. So I just went from doing 15 years instead of 40 to, what does that mean? It means you're going home. I'm going home? Oh, my God. That's what it was like. I mean, 15 people over here, it's like, we all breathed at one time, you know? And, you know, I mean, it's like remembering moments like that where you're like, God said, okay, kid, all right. Comes a place in this program where you got to make an even playing field. Like all the stuff that happened and all the stuff you're forgiven for. Okay? And they got to come to an even place where there's grace on both sides. Because if I will just move through the hurt that still exists in my life from those experiences, and I will allow this program to work by working the program, because it takes effort on my part. When I was, I mean, not that long ago, it was freeze, man. Oh, I was free. I didn't have any prison. This was great. And now it's, I don't want to feel this stuff. I don't want to feel these feelings. This is what I drink over. I don't want to hurt like this. I don't walk around in circles in my house. Because then that's all I got. But that's what it takes. It's what it's going to take. You know, I learned that on a day-to-day basis. You know, it just takes me hitting my knees. It takes me doing the wrong thing, saying the wrong thing, having the wrong attitude, having to make amends. And sharing that stuff makes me a part of you again instead of so separate from you again with all this stuff, right? Because just because it's a little different, the story's a little different, a lot of the hurt is the same, a lot of confusion is the same. If you come from an alcoholic family, it's very baffling and it's very confusing, and some of the same senses and feelings that we had. So anyway, where I'm at right now is that I'm coming up on 8 years of sobriety. And, you know, it's time. That's, you know, I'm in that place where, you know, you don't see a lot of 6s, 7s, 8s, 9s, 10s, right? You got the early birds, and you got the early birds. You know? So I'm really grateful to have, like, people like Ellen in my life. I mean, somebody with strong recovery who is a big book, you know, lover of the big book, how this program works, my partner in my life to help me grow, to help me see myself more clearly, and you know, just I have hope when I see, you know, I have hope when I see you, because you've been through so many of these things in different phases, and I hear that, and you're like, you're at this phase, but guess what? There's one down the road at like 12, so don't make such a big deal of this, because it's just a layer, you know, just a layer. But, you know, it's a good layer, because I'm getting down in that really good, yeah, right? If I get through the yeah, all this other stuff will be like, right? It would be right size, you know. That's what this program does for us. And that's what I say, you know, it's not me. It's not, you're not doing it for me. You know, it's doing it for us. when we share honestly, openly, when we're willing, when you're gut level, when you're willing to be ugly in front of your, you know, closest people, you know, so you can grow up. Because I'd say I have arrested development. What do you think? But anyway, it's 5 minutes still. It's an honor and a privilege to be here, to be able to grow, to have a home, to have friends. I've never met a single one of you people here. And, you know, you couldn't be more welcome. You know? I'm not an outcast. And I really thank you for that. Thank you for letting me be here. Thanks.